introducing Bernie Sanders. They spent a lot of time together in Atlanta, and Killer Mike just posted this, I think, hour-long barbershop interview, because he owns a barbershop in Atlanta, with Bernie Sanders. But the significance of this, Bob Herbert, and I think it's starting a trend with hip-hop artists endorsing Bernie Sanders. A poll just showed, what was it, ABC Nightly News, a major newscast, has devoted something like 81 minutes to Donald Trump compared to, is it 20 seconds, less than a minute, to Bernie Sanders?
Isn't that something? So we're now at the stage where, after all these years that I've been in the media, I have to get my perspective from hip-hop artists. I can't get it from the mainstream media. The hip-hop artists are making far more sense. You know, I have not tended to beat up on the press or the media. You know, people use it as a whipping boy all the time, and I just don't. That's where we get our information from, and it's crucial to democracy. But I think that its coverage of this presidential campaign has been really horrible. And so, you know, last night the debate focused almost entirely on ISIS. And, you know, and all the focus has been on Donald Trump. And Trump is now leading because he's the most famous person in this celebrity-obsessed country. It's crazy.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Zed Jilani of The Intercept, Arun Kudnani of NYU, and the book The Muslims Are Coming, Stephen Zunis at the University of San Francisco, and Bob Herbert of Demos. That does it for our broadcast. I am Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website's democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned in at KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Up next, the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio and Heartbeat Silent Sound Systems proudly presents Silent Nights 2015, a silent disco and silent auction benefit for KBOO, December 19th, 8 p.m. at Manifestation PDX. This very special silent disco features talented KBOO DJs and MCs. You'll have three channels of danceable jams to choose from, including bluegrass, the Grateful Dead, reggae, afrobeat, world music, hip-hop, funk and soul, electronic dance music, bhangra, and global bass music. There's something for everyone. We'll also feature a silent auction with art from local artists as well. Silent Nights will be on Saturday, December 19th, from 8 p.m. to midnight at Manifestation PDX, 2020 Southeast Bush Street in Portland. For more information on the lineup and tickets and more, go to kboo.fm/silentnights2015. That's Silent Nights 2015, a benefit for our community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Don't say what you mean. That's Drinking from Puddles, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yeah.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a mistrial has been declared in the case of a Baltimore police officer charged with the death of Freddie Gray.
Portland City Council takes a stand against Islamophobia and in support of refugees.
The 40-year-old ban on crude oil in the U.S. is set to be lifted after Republican legislators slipped a rider into the omnibus spending bill headed for passage later this week.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 16th, 2015. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. A judge has declared a mistrial in the first of six cases against Baltimore police officers for the wrongful death of Freddie Gray. Riot police and surplus military vehicles have been deployed in the streets of Baltimore in anticipation of protests. Organizer and activist Darius Rosebrough was taken into custody outside the courthouse this afternoon as he led a chant calling for justice for Freddie Gray. 25-year-old Freddie Gray was killed in April when his spinal cord was severed during a so-called rough ride. This is a technique used by Baltimore police against people they have arrested, particularly young black men. In the rough ride, police put the subject in the back of a van while handcuffed, then drive the van aggressively and abruptly in order to cause injury. In this case, the injuries were so severe that they led to Freddie Gray's death. Six officers are facing charges, the first time ever that a so-called rough ride practice has faced public scrutiny. Baltimore Police Officer William Porter was the first to go on trial. The jury has struggled for 3 days to reach a verdict. When they were unable to come to a consensus, the judge today decided to declare a mistrial. During the trial of Officer Porter, both the prosecution and the defense talked about the culture and policies of the Baltimore Police Department. Prosecutors suggested that the department has a stop snitching code for its officers, just as repulsive as the one on the streets. And defense attorneys didn't just portray Mr. Porter as an inexperienced cop who was following the lead of experienced officers. They drew a picture of a department where training is virtually non-existent and where standards of conduct are routinely ignored.
In local news, a lawsuit against the Portland police for profiling a Native American woman from Northeast Portland has resulted in a mistrial. Lisa Haynes says she was racially profiled by police 3 years ago. Haynes was on her way to volunteer for Free Geek, an organization which builds computers for nonprofit groups, when she was stopped by police. When she asserted her constitutional right to not speak to them, she was violently searched and arrested. Multiple complaints filed by Haynes exonerated the officers of any wrongdoing. With the mistrial declaration, the officers were not found guilty. However, Haynes may have the chance to file a new lawsuit against them.
The 40-year-old ban on U.S. oil exports will likely be lifted by the end of this week. Republican lawmakers and oil companies managed to slip the measure into the massive budget bill that needs to pass in order to avoid a government shutdown. The end of the oil export ban could be a game changer for the Northwest, according to Eric DePlace of the Sightline Institute. He spoke with KBOO's Galen Sanford today about the implications of lifting the ban on oil exports.
This is Galen Sanford. I'm here speaking with Eric DePlace of the Sightline Institute. Eric, what will ending the ban on crude oil exports mean for the Northwest?
Well, this is an oil industry giveaway, and what it means is dismantling a 40-year-old energy conservation and energy independence law that we've had on the books. For the Northwest, it means that we are even more under threat of large-scale oil transport schemes. We have already seen proposals to move 1 million barrels of oil per day by train to the Northwest. This is going to dial up the pressure on this region because we face such valuable Pacific markets.
So what would you say the dangers are, either physical or otherwise?
Well, the dangers, they start with the basic risks of moving large quantities of oil. If, in fact, the export ban does go away, and if prices support moving large quantities of oil to the Pacific, that means the Northwest is going to be at risk of fires from oil train derailments, which are very real and very scary, and at risk of increased oil spills, both from rail accidents and also from tanker vessels that would take the crude oil away. On top of that, I think there's a very real risk that the Northwest, sort of culturally and in terms of governance, becomes more dominated by the oil industry than it is now. And that can have very corrosive effects for democracy.
You say that this means current analysis of oil projects are obsolete. So what exactly do you mean by that? What would need to be reassessed?
What's happened so far with respect to oil train projects is that they have tended to look at them with kind of one eye shut, and they have examined them not with respect to their cumulative impacts, but with respect to just their impacts on a specific parcel of land. In the absence of the export ban, I think it is imperative that we take a cumulative region-wide view of these projects and of how they fit into oil transport schemes more generally. When we do that, I think we'll see that the impacts are quite a bit larger than the analyses have suggested so far. And to be clear, the formal analyses that we have seen for these projects so far all operate under the assumption that the export ban is in place. So if we're going to take away this long-standing, very important constraint on the oil industry, it is, in my judgment, imperative that we go back and do those analyses correctly and get the facts right about what the oil expansions mean or could mean for this region.
So do you see this as potentially leading to other energy industries trying to gain a toehold in this region?
Well, we're already facing a tsunami of these types of projects. We have everything from large-scale coal export projects proposed, methanol refineries, liquefied natural gas in Oregon, certainly large-scale oil by rail all over the Pacific Northwest, oil pipelines in British Columbia. So the Pacific Northwest region is really under threat of just staggering quantities of fossil energy development projects. What's happening here is that we're seeing one of the most powerful and insidious industries on the planet, the oil industry, erode longstanding laws in order to get their way. And it's quite likely they will ramp up continued pressure on the Northwest. I wouldn't be surprised if the gas industry tries something similar soon.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate you doing the story.
Yeah, no problem.
That was KBOO's Galen Sanford speaking with the Sideline Institute's Eric DePlace.
The Portland City Council met this afternoon to hear testimony in relation to a proposed resolution to declare support for the city's Muslim community. The measure also reaffirms the City of Portland's welcome for all immigrants and refugees. The resolution was submitted jointly by all members of the City Council. Here's some testimony from Imam Abdullah Pulovina and Portland resident Wajid Saeed.
Mayor Hales and Commissioner Fish and I had the opportunity to spend 3 hours with our Muslim brothers and sisters on Saturday at the opening of the Muslim Educational Trust Community Center in Tigard. It was a wonderful gathering of people from every section of our community, and anybody who doubts that we are a community should have been there that day. It was wonderful. So thank you all for gathering here again today.
Commissioner Fritz, can I correct you on one point? There were so many speakers and so many people of goodwill at the gathering that it actually lasted 4.5 hours.
That's a good thing. With that, let me call on some folks for invited testimony, and I know there are several others here who'd like to speak as well. First, I want to invite Imam Abdullah Pulovina, please, to come forward.
In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Most Merciful, my name is Abdullah Pulovina. I'm an imam. Dear and Honorable Mayor Hales, members of Portland City Council, brothers and sisters, I would like to greet you with the greeting of Islam, and that greeting is greeting of peace. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon all of you. This is a great day for us Muslims here and Americans. My understanding of today's day is that we came here to proclaim that our strength is truth, that our destiny is justice, that love is our hope, that peace is our lesson. We came here to find the means and methods and to exercise them to move forward in building a better society in which we will love each other, respect one another, and accept our diversity as a bucket of different flowers with good aroma. Today I see the true America. I see the land of the brave, the land of the free. So dear Mayor and members of the Council, I thank you. May God bless your hearts and souls, and may God bless your work for this beautiful city and all its citizens, irrespective of color, creed, religion. So in that manner, I will finish with one prayer. O God, please grant guidance, success, and happiness to all of us here and to all of our leaders in this beautiful city, state, and country. You are the source of peace. Let there be peace in all of us. Amen. Thank you.
My name is Wajdi Saeed. Respected Mayor Hales and respected commissioners, Portland residents and all communities must stand with American Muslim communities and the Arab Americans against bigotry and hate, and as well as against the so-called Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, and not against Muslims because of ISIS. Respected Mayor Hales and respected commissioners, tourism has no religion and no community should be singled out as being its source. History tends to repeat itself in so many occasions, but with different targets, different groups face the same phobia from the public in the past. The ethnic cleansing of the Native Americans, the African slavery, the Spanish Inquisition against Jews and Muslims, the Holocaust, the Japanese-American imprisonment, and the anti-Mexican sentiments in the public square. We have to confront racism with ourselves as individuals and as communities to become better human beings. The phony so-called Republican presidential candidates, the dirty dozen, the 12 of American leading Islamophobes that the fairness and accuracy in reporting have stated, and leaders of ISIS know that they cannot defeat us here in Portland or over the nation. So these dirty-minded groups' only hope is to divide us as Americans of different ethnicities and different religions along religious and ethnic lines. The Portland, Oregon, and National American Muslims and Arab Americans, and I say Arab Americans because there are a lot of Arabs that are Christians, that some of them are present today. Communities have been unanimous in their condemnation of all kinds of form of violence and religious extremism and violence of any sort. Despite our condemnation, respected mayor and commissioners, of extremism and violence, hate-filled rhetoric and anti-Muslim attacks and anti-Arab attacks and anti-Semitism are putting the lives of American Muslims and so many individuals and minorities and their families in real danger. At times like this, when many people are sowing seeds of division, hate, and fear, it is heartwarming to know that there are good individuals like you making a public statement in spite of all our politics and our affiliation and our division. Here we are successful partners in getting a resolution that history will be remembered. The fight against Islamophobia, anti-African, anti-Semitism, anti-woman, anti-immigrants is necessary to defend our democracy.
KBOO reporter Jenna Yokoyama also spoke with Lynn Fuchigami, executive director of Oregon Nikkei Endowment at City Hall.
We are a nonprofit that preserves and honors, shares the history of the Japanese Americans in the Pacific Northwest. We educate the public about their experience during World War II and of course, advocate for the protection of civil liberties and civil rights. I'm also a member of the Portland JCL, which is the local chapter of our largest and oldest Asian American civil rights organization in the United States. So felt it was really important to be here today to stand up on behalf of the Muslim community and speak out against this very hateful rhetoric and Islamophobic sentiment that you hear so much in throughout the country today. This type of rhetoric that really led to the mass incarceration of 120,000 Japanese Americans during World War II. And so we want to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again. And we feel that we know only too well firsthand what happens when people don't stand up and speak out on behalf of communities. So
that was audio from today's City Council testimony in support of the resolution to declare support for the city's Muslim community and to reaffirm Portland's welcome for all immigrants and refugees. The measure passed unanimously by all members of the City Council.
Critics are saying that a new terror alert system from the Department of Homeland Security that focuses on so-called self-radicalized actors amounts to the criminalization of thought crimes. The introduction of the new system apparently comes as a response to the San Bernardino shootings, in which 14 people were killed by a husband and wife who are allegedly influenced by Daesh. That's the group currently wreaking havoc in Iraq and Syria using mainly U.S.-sourced weapons. The new initiative from the Department of Homeland Security will issue bulletins to the public about people whom the department believes are radicalized. What this means and how much of a threat the people in question actually present is not addressed by the Department of Homeland Security. According to Jay Johnson, the head of the department, the National Terrorism Advisory System will consist of two kinds of advisories, bulletins and alerts. If there is sufficient information regarding a credible specific threat against the U.S., the department will release an alert. But if there's a non-specific threat from someone who is, quote, radicalized in their thoughts and online postings, the department will issue a bulletin. Johnson also said there will be an increase in law enforcement personnel at big events in the coming months.
listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 16th, 2015. At 6 o'clock, it's Occupy Portland Radio. Tonight's show features Chaos Theory Radio from the Occupy the Media Collective. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in the Portland area should be rainy with winds of 10 to 20 miles an hour and a high of 52 degrees, moving to high winds with over an inch of rainfall and a low of 47 tomorrow night. Today in history, in 1899, the British playwright Noel Coward was born. Coward was known for his flamboyance and wit and was the author of the play Blithe Spirit and the novel Pomp and Circumstance, among many other works. Our quote of the day is also from Noel Coward. He said, "It is discouraging how many people are shocked by honesty and how few by deceit."
It's 5:20, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
They say that if you get up in the morning and swallow a live toad, nothing worse will happen to you for the rest of the day. Well, we Americans have just been fed a live toad by the World Trade Organization. Last May, the WTO, an oligarchic, autocratic governing entity essentially run by and for multinational corporations, ruled that a U.S. consumer protection law called COOL violates one of WTO's obscure trade rules. COOL stands for Country of Origin Labeling, a straightforward requirement that meat sold in the U.S. be labeled so consumers can know where it came from. This was passed by our Congress, signed by our President, upheld by our courts, and is supported by 92% of our people. But corporate meat processors in Canada and Mexico, including U.S. meat conglomerates with operations there, don't want you and me to know this basic information. So they got Canadian and Mexican government officials to do an end run around our sovereign people and government by filing a claim against COOL in the shadowy corporate trade organization. WTO's May ruling dutifully put the profits of these few global meat purveyors over the democratic will of some 300 million Americans. COOL must go, decreed these faceless, unelected servants of the corporate order. Now for today's toad. To enforce this demand, the WTO dictated on December 7th, ironically Pearl Harbor Day, that Canada and Mexico may now punish us by imposing import bans against products we make. How big is this toad? It bans more than $1 billion a year in foreign sales of U.S. products unless and until Congress guts our people's consumer labeling law. This is Jim Hightower saying, who's in charge here? Why are our Congress critters and President meekly swallowing this? For answers, go to Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, citizen.org/trade.
The Federal Reserve voted today to increase interest rates in the U.S. for the first time in 9 years. The decision to increase rates by 0.25% drew skepticism from economists at the Center for Economic and Policy Research Center. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with their co-founder, Dr. Dean Baker, about his concerns on what the rate hike will mean both domestically and internationally.
You guys had a doubtful response to the Federal Reserve's interest rate hike today. Can you explain why?
Well, the basic story is the economy growing too fast or too slowly? You know, do we think that there are too many jobs out there or too few? And if you think there's too many, then it's appropriate for the Fed to raise interest rates, try and slow the economy, try and make it so that we have fewer jobs. If you think the opposite, if you think we really need more jobs and you'd rather see the economy speed up, well, you don't want to see the Fed raise interest rates. And I think we're in that latter situation. Some numbers, you know, people focus on the unemployment rate. 5% is not terribly high, so you could look at that and go, okay, well, maybe they should raise rates. But a lot of other measures of the labor market indicate that it's very, very weak. Just the most obvious, we often look at the employment rate, the percentage of people that have jobs rather than those that are unemployed. That's down by more than 3 percentage points from the pre-recession level. The reason that doesn't show up in unemployment is that a lot of people have just dropped out of labor force. You only count as being unemployed if you say you're looking for work. A lot of people say they're no longer looking for work, they don't count as unemployed. My view, and that many other economists, is that if the economy picked up, if it were strong, many of these people would want jobs, and they're not looking for jobs now because they don't see any out there. Some other measures, the length, the duration of unemployment spells, those are very much at recession levels. The percentage of people that are working part-time with like full-time jobs, again, that's very much at a recession level. So there's a number of labor market indicators that suggest the labor market's still very weak. And most importantly, or at least to my view, one of the most important measures, wages. Wages are not rising particularly rapidly. There's not really any evidence that wage growth has accelerated. That would be the fear of the Fed, that wage growth is suddenly rising very rapidly and going to cause inflation. We're just not seeing that, and in fact, we're below their inflation target. So by a whole range of measures, it looks to me like there's just no reason to justify this sort of rate hike.
This is the first time the rate has changed since 2006, and I find myself curious as to whether anyone has benefited from monetary policy the right expression?
That's the correct expression. Yeah, I mean, I think the low interest rates have been very beneficial to the economy. That's meant a huge drop in mortgage interest rates. We had mortgage interest rates. The 30-year mortgage rate was down under 4% for a time. I think we're very close to, I haven't looked at it today, but we're very close to 4% now, but it's down, you know, 3.7, 3.8, levels not seen since, you probably have to go back to the 1950s. Car loans are at very low rates. The low mortgage rates are important not just for people buying homes, but tens of millions of people were able to refinance their homes. And in many cases, that was the difference between losing your home and keeping it. So that was a really big deal. It put more money in the economy, helped to boost growth. To some extent, firms invest more at lower interest rates. Also, cities, state and local governments are able to borrow at lower rates. So both it freed up money for other purposes and also made it easier for them to undertake infrastructure spending. So I think it's definitely a positive impact. It hasn't been, to my view, as much as I would have liked, at least. I mean, again, I was saying how we still have a weak labor market. I'd like to see more people with jobs. I'd like to see wages rising more. But had the Fed not had this zero interest rate policy and other efforts to boost growth over the last 7 years, I have no doubt we would be talking about millions more people out of work and lower pay for those who are working, more people having lost their homes. So to my view, it isn't even close. This was definitely the right thing for them to have done.
What are signs to look for if it is indeed the wrong time to raise rates?
Well, what we want to see is there evidence that it's slowing the economy. And we won't see the impact right away. There's all these different pieces of data that we, meaning economists, it takes a while for the impact of this to be felt. So they raised rates today. It will start to show up in the economy next month, the month after. There's a lag between when something actually happens in the economy and we get the data that shows that something has happened in the economy. So as we go along, we'll, of course, be looking, is there evidence that the economy is slowing? And my concern is that that will be there and that will indicate that this was the wrong move.
Are there repercussions internationally for our raising rates?
Yes, there are going to be some, and it will be interesting. I could say interesting sitting here in Washington, D.C., maybe less interesting for people elsewhere, but we will see how those play out. Some of those are likely to be positive. One of the reasons I don't like the rate hike is it raises the value of the dollar, which makes our goods and services less competitive internationally. So a higher value dollar means everything that we're trying to sell overseas costs our trading partners, cost the people who might buy it in Europe and Japan and China, cost them more money. So our exports fall. Flip side of that, imports are now cheaper for us. You know, so it's good, we want to get cheap imports. On the other hand, our domestic producers are put at a disadvantage. So that's a bad side from the standpoint of the United States. The positive side is our trading partners. So if you look to Europe, look to East Asia, those countries will benefit from the fact that the interest rate is, that the dollar is somewhat higher, since it will improve their trade situation. Where the effect is going to be more ambiguous and quite possibly negative is Latin America, because there you have a number of countries where they have higher inflation rates than they want, and if their currencies fall against the dollar rises against their currency, that's going to make goods they import more expensive, meaning that they're going to have still higher inflation. So that will give those countries a choice that they could either try to prevent the dollar from rising against their currencies, which would mean raising interest rates and slowing their own economies, or alternatively letting the dollar rise and getting by with somewhat higher inflation. To my view, I would in general say can live with the higher inflation, but that may not be the call they would make. And in any case, either end of that is probably not good news for people in Latin America. So that's where, you know, we're likely to see some negative impact. And again, I don't want to overplay the quarter point. The big issue is if we see more interest rate hikes going forward in 2016.
What do you think the average American does not know enough about the Federal Reserve?
I think people in general know very, very little about the Federal Reserve Board. I'm saying that even among people in Washington, not that people in Washington are so smart, but politics is their business for the most part. And the importance of the Federal Reserve Board, the makeup of the Federal Reserve Board, there's remarkably little understanding of it. I mean, part of it is that it's a very sort of confusing process. A long time in my economics career before I realized exactly what the Fed was, the 12 district banks, how these people are appointed. It's a real hodgepodge. It was set up over 100 years ago. No one in their right mind would set up anything like it today. I think there's very little awareness of exactly what the Fed is and how important it is. And one of the things that's been striking to me, and we're already into the presidential campaign, and all the candidates are putting their proposals out saying, I have this great tax cut plan to create jobs, and, you know, the Democrats are saying, you know, we want to have infrastructure. And, you know, you could argue what's good or what's bad there, but if the Federal Reserve Board doesn't want there to be more jobs, then even if your tax cut plan's great, we won't have more jobs. And even if your infrastructure plan is great, we won't have more jobs, because the Fed's going to put its foot on the brake, raise interest rates, and they're going to keep the economy from creating jobs. So it's remarkable that, you know, people are talking about the economy, putting forward plans, and no one says anything about the Federal Reserve Board. Because if the Federal Reserve Board isn't in tune, if they're not going along and saying, okay, that's great, you're going to create more jobs, we're going to sit back and let you create more jobs, it won't matter. They'll stifle these plans for growth and for job creation. So, yeah, I think there's very little understanding of what the Fed is.
I've been talking with economist Dr. Dean Baker from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. For more information, you can visit their website at cepr.net. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
As environmentalists in Oregon fight to put the state's 90 gray wolves back on the endangered species list, a roadside zoo in Minnesota is facing a lawsuit for killing large numbers of gray wolves to sell their pelts. The owner of the zoo, called Forever Wild, has faced lawsuits in the past for mistreatment of animals. In a 2012 court deposition, the owner of the petting zoo admitted to killing over two dozen wolves that year alone and to selling their pelts to fur companies. She told the court at that time that the number of wolves she killed each year depended on the price that she could get for their pelts. On the Forever Wild Facebook page, owner Terry Petter accuses animal rights activists of being emotionally immature and of acting out because they were abused by their parents. She makes no apologies for her company's actions and practices and has numerous posts promoting hunting and support for the U.S. military. The Animal Legal Defense Fund has filed the new lawsuit against Forever Wild, saying that they were tipped off by animal rights activists who are attempting to stop Petter from opening a second location in South Dakota. Although Petter did succeed in opening the second facility, it was forced to shut down after just 10 weeks due to strength of local opposition.
In the midst of the holiday season, some people have thoughts of roasting chestnuts on an open fire. But a handful of scientists are working to genetically engineer the iconic American chestnut tree. The scientists hope to release this genetically modified chestnut into the wild throughout the Appalachian region as early as next year. Indigenous people, scientists, and environmental groups are raising alarms about the potential risks of these trees. These groups argue that because of the unassessed risks, genetically engineered trees should not be approved by the federal government to be planted in the wild. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Annie Peterman, the executive director of the Global Justice Ecology Project, for more about genetically engineered chestnuts.
What's the situation with genetically engineered chestnuts in the U.S.?
Sure. There has been research going on genetically engineered American chestnuts for a couple of decades now, and the scientists who are working on it, they're working on blight resistance. The American chestnut was largely wiped out by blight in the first half of the 1900s, and as a result, they started doing this genetically engineered work to bring it back more quickly than the other techniques that were being used. So there's already been a hybridization program that's been going on for quite some time, as well as a program to naturally bring it back naturally by breeding naturally resistant American chestnuts with each other. But of course, the genetic engineering is much quicker and, you know, a more sexy thing. So it's getting a lot more attention and a lot more funding is being directed there. But of course, as opposed to the other varieties, these have many more dangers involved because of the transgenic techniques being used.
What's the difference between the hybridization breeding processes and the genetic engineering of these trees?
The ma- main difference with the genetic engineering process and the non-transgenic process is that they are taking foreign material and forcing it into the cells of these trees, into the DNA of these trees, to make them do things that they wouldn't naturally do. So the hybridization program is actually using Chinese chestnuts and breeding them with the American chestnuts because the Chinese chestnuts have a natural resistance to the blight. And so they've been doing that and creating a hybrid chestnut tree. But that, of course, is involving two trees of similar similar species, and also it's not involving the high-tech, genetic engineering processes of taking the DNA out of the cell and forcing it into another cell. That's where you really get into a lot of trouble because it causes a lot of mutations, it causes a lot of unintended impacts to the cell, to the DNA, and those unintended impacts then get translated into the environment in ways that you can't predict. So a genetically engineered chestnut will have very unpredictable impacts in the forest. It could have dangerous impacts on wildlife or people that eat the chestnuts. These are edible chestnuts that we're talking about. And it could have impacts on, soils, water, so on. And so there's all these risks that go along with genetically engineered chestnuts that we're very concerned about, don't believe can be assessed adequately, and so we are pushing for them to be flat-out rejected.
And what is the current status of the genetic engineering of chestnuts? Are there actually genetically engineered chestnuts on the market at this point?
There are not genetically engineered chestnuts on the market, which is the good part. They're still in the field trial phase and in the testing phase, but Dr. William Powell, who's doing these genetically engineered chestnuts at the State University of New York in Syracuse, very much wants to start the deregulation process in 2016 and has, in fact, already been in contact with the various U.S. agencies to figure out what steps he needs to go through to get these trees deregulated. So once they're deregulated, that means they're legalized. That means that they can be planted out into the forests, which is the idea with these. They're not intended for plantations, they're intended to be released directly into native forests with the intention that they will contaminate native American chestnuts with their pollen so that the wild American chestnuts will become, supposedly resistant to this blight as well, but will also be then subject to all of the potentially unintended and dangerous impacts of these GE chestnuts.
So the website to go to for more information and to get involved is nogetrees.org. Again, I've been speaking with Ann Peterman. She's part of the Global Justice Ecology Project. They're working to stop the approval of genetically engineered chestnut trees in the United States that's now being pushed through. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Wednesday, December 16th, 2015. Israeli attacks targeting the West Bank and Gaza leave 3 killed and a dozen injured. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.
Israeli soldiers invaded on Wednesday at dawn the Qalandia refugee camp north of occupied Jerusalem, shot and killed 2 Palestinians and wounded at least 4 others. The army claimed that 3 soldiers were injured in ramming incident. The slain Palestinians have been identified as Ahmed Hajahja, 21, from the Qalandia refugee camp, and Hikmat Hamadan from the Albira city, were killed in the refugee camp, and at least 4 Palestinians were shot with live fire. Hajahja was a second-year journalism student at the Modern University College in Ramallah, in addition to being an active with the Kalandia Media Center. He was also related to Yunus Jahjouh, 22, who was killed by Israeli army, along with Robin Ziad, 32, and Jihad Asalan, 19, in a similar invasion 2 years ago. A third Palestinian died of her wounds on Wednesday after being shot by Israeli soldiers at a military checkpoint near Nablus city in northern West Bank. Samah Abd al-Mun'im was shot at the Hawara military checkpoint on October 23rd when the Israeli troops opened fire in all directions, fatally hitting the teenager and killing Ala Hashash, 16, after he allegedly attempted to stab an Israeli soldier. The Palestinian Ministry of Health announced on Wednesday that the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli gunfire since October 1st have reached now 125, including 25 children. Also on Wednesday, 15 Palestinian students were shot and injured by Israeli troops with both rubber-coated steel bullets and live fire during a protest at the Palestine Technical University in the northern occupied West Bank district of Tul Karim, media sources and the Red Crescent said. Moreover, Israeli soldiers invaded on Wednesday at dawn various Palestinian communities in different parts of the occupied West Bank, broke into and ransacked dozens of homes, and kidnapped at least 11 Palestinians. In the Gaza Strip, 4 Palestinian civilians were injured when Israeli tanks bombarded Al-Farahin area in Khan Yunis city in northern Gaza Strip. Palestinian medical sources said that among the injured, one man is in critical condition. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, December 16, 2015, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassa Banoura.
The New York Civil Liberties Union has won a victory for prison reform in the state of New York. The state has agreed to spend $62 million to convert solitary confinement units into group learning spaces. The state has also agreed to move one quarter of its inmates in solitary units into more normalized housing and to train corrections officers in de-escalation techniques to minimize instances that would get inmates moved into solitary. The agreement also stipulates that the state prison system will limit its use of solitary for disciplinary purposes and will give inmates in solitary more privileges, such as access to reading materials and telephone calls. Inmates will also no longer be served food known as, quote, the loaf, a dense mixture of vegetable, meat, and nuts that many consider inedible. The 3-year agreement comes on the heels of similar improvements in prison systems in the state, in states such as California. The New York agreement was also spurred by a determination from the U.S. Department of Justice of a pattern of abuse of 16- and 17-year-old inmates that breached their constitutional rights.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jimmy Tardy, Robin Ryan, and Jenna Yokoyama. The producer is Galen Sanford. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. Or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty looks at recent cases of police on trial for rape and murder. She also discusses a trip to Scotland by a group of police officers to learn from police there who do their jobs without firearms. At 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, with host Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Parafogreen speaks with Stephen F. Cohen about his recent interview in The Nation titled Coalition or Cold War with Russia. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on Between the Covers, host David Nyman interviews writer Mary Gateskill about her new novel, The Mare. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO News from the Boo with
Mike
and
Monica Beamer.
It's Wednesday at 5:45, which means it's time once again for News from the Boo, our weekly roundup of news and items of interest from here inside the station and the greater listening community. We're joined tonight by station co-manager Mike Crenshaw, just back from Africa. Hello, Mike. How you doing?
Good, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing great. We would like to talk, before we get to the interest, really interesting stuff, let's get some business out of the way first. How did our winter drive do?
The winter drive went well. We landed close to our goal of 55,000, about 5,000 short. If folks